The Daily. I need The Daily. You got The Daily with Dave Hodgson.
Delighted to invite my friend Tony Gosling on, who's a regular on the show. And Tony Gosling from the website Bilderberg.org. And I first saw Tony on Russia Today. Found him very interesting, talking about the Bilderberg Group at the time, with an interviewer there on Russia Today. And I'm delighted to have him on the line with me now. Good afternoon, Tony. How are you?
Fine, Dave. Actually, it's a beautiful day here in sunny Wiltshire, looking out over the downs on a bit of a country walk. An absolutely stonking day.
I'm glad that you're out there, because I know, speaking to you in the past, Tony, that you have so much stuff going on in your head, news items coming from all over the world and so on. So I'm glad that you can get out in the countryside and have a bit of a clear out of it now and then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the principle being, really, what we're doing in Bristol with our radio show is we're doing a national and international news plus local news. And there really doesn't seem to be hardly anybody else doing that. I mean, all of the British media, as in many other countries, particularly in the Western world, is focused and centred in London. All of the national stories and the news wire agencies, all of the big newspapers are based in London.
Yes.
And the TV, obviously, the national... I mean, even with the things like the regional BBC and regional ITV, they only deal with the local stuff. They don't touch the international and they don't touch the national. Mm. So what we're doing is trying to break the mould with our radio show. And in a way, we're following in the footsteps of the old Manchester Guardian. Because the Manchester Guardian started up... after the Peterloo Massacre, which was a sort of big social struggle in the 1800s. And they decided they were going to start a regional newspaper in Manchester, but they were going to also do a Manchester take on the national and international news. And so that's what similar type of thing we're trying to do from Bristol.
Fantastic. Now, there's lots of stuff happening all the time, and I'm getting emails from you all the time, Tony. First of all, let's touch on the cabinet reshuffle, and that's very much in the news at the moment, and Prime Minister's Question Time today. Ed Miliband sticking his oar in, of course, with David Cameron giving as good as he gets. What do you make of it all? Is it just a moving around of the deck chairs type thing?
Well, yes, to a certain extent. But I'll tell you one thing that's really irritated me is the fact that Lord Green is still in his place. Now, I mean, this is something you won't hear from any of the other commentators. In fact, I haven't. I've been listening intently the last day or so.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to have mentioned Lord Green. He's a government minister. He could quite easily have been moved out. He's never been elected in his life. I mean, he's the former chairman of HSBC. In fact, he was in charge of HSBC over in the United States when they were doing the money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels, and he was warned about it too and did nothing at all. So effectively, what we've got is we've got a guy who's sitting in the government as a minister, and there's been no mention of the fact that he could have been reshuffled but wasn't, even though he's effectively the treasurer for some of the most cruel people on the planet. These Mexican drug cartels simply turn up in a village, massacre everybody, put the bodies in trucks and then dump them by the side of the road. And this is absolutely appalling.
Tony, if this is true, why are the other news agencies not talking about it? Why are you the only one talking about it?
Well, I mean, it may be that they're just focusing on the cabinet, but of course the reshuffle doesn't just take into account the cabinet, it's all of the ministers. The cabinet ministers are the senior people. Because what happens is, as you change the ministers at the top, they affects everything. You know, you get some people go up the ladder, some people go down the ladder. So, you know, the fact that Lord Green has just been completely untouched by all this, to me, stinks. The other thing, of course, is we've seen some, you know, quite big changes. What with Ken Clark being moved out of the Justice Ministry. Now, he's a Bilderberg character. He's one of these... people who are involved with this, you know, elite set of the super financial elite, which was started by the Nazis and very, very secret, started by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a Nazi spy during the war and also actually a member of the SS, an officer in the SS before the war, including a member of the Nazi Party when he was at university. And Clark is a member of this club, very secretive, very powerful club that controls much of the money in the Western world. So it's good to see him shifted out. He's now gone on to a job which is a minister without portfolio.
Peter Mandelson.
And of course, one of the unsaid... well, that's right, exactly like Mandelson. And one of the unsaid things in some of the commentary about this reshuffle is that really what you're going to do is you're going to look at the budgets of all of the ministries that these people have been taken away from or put into. Mm. That's a large part of their responsibility, is how much public money are they responsible for during the year. And Ken Clark has gone from a massive budget at the Ministry of Justice to nothing now. He's basically being somebody who's in the cabinet room, and he is a press spokesperson. We'll see a lot more of him on the TV in the months and weeks to come.
Yeah.
As a spokesperson for the Tory Party. I mean, he seems to be someone who's very good at dealing with the press. And, you know, I would like to see him deal with the essential problem for me right now, which is that we've got a cabinet of millionaires. We had a budget which was actually tailor-made for millionaires and stealing from people like the disabled to give to those millionaires. And we've had no disclosure whatsoever, even though we were promised it at the time, about what holdings the cabinet have right now in offshore tax havens. I mean, I'd like to know, I would guess that something like 80% of David Cameron's personal wealth is in places like Panama and the Cayman Islands, and they really should come clean and tell the world how much of their personal wealth is been deliberately put outside the country and away from the tax man, because this is becoming the issue. Is these super rich people are the reason why we've got a deficit, because they are simply not paying the tax, Dave.
Actually, we're talking to Tony Gosling from Bilbo.org on Talk Radio Europe. If you want to call him, you can. 951-036-026. 951-036-026. I notice a lot of the top ministers have stayed in their position, the Chancellor. William Hague, who... Let's move on to what we were talking about off earlier on, Tony, about British foreign policy and how it's not always as it appears.
No, Hague has stayed, but I mean, you know, he's... I think it's important to see how British foreign policy is made and where it comes from, because we've had some glaring differences in our stated policy and what we actually do. One of them was on Newsnight earlier this week, a special report by the Newsnight team looking at the failure of the British authorities to seize the assets of Hosni Mubarak, the former Egyptian president, and his friends, post the Arab Spring. Now, this is something that they promised to do. In fact, they were forced by law to do 18 months ago, and we had all sorts of promises, yes, we're going to freeze the assets. 18 months down the line, these assets have not been freezed, and of course, it only takes somebody who's in fear of having their assets seized a few days to move those assets out of one account. And the fact that the British government hasn't done this, it's mainly the Treasury who are responsible for this, hasn't seized the assets, tells us something very, very clear. Because I mean, what they're doing is they've seized the assets of Colonel Gaddafi, the Libyan leader, and President Assad had about £100 million in London. I mean, obviously, he was a little bit wary of London, so he didn't have all his money there. But that money was seized instantly. And it hasn't happened with Hosni Mubarak's Egyptian money. And what we're looking at here, really, is a shadow foreign policy. So there's one foreign policy which is stated, i.e. that we will do what we are committed to do by international law in these circumstances. And there's another shadow foreign policy, which is essentially we will look after our mates and we will only implement the law when it comes to people that we don't like. And that's the way that the government's being run. But how, you know, you may well ask, Dave, who is it that actually formulates this policy and who tells William Hague what to do? Well, you've got to look at this institution in St James in London, just off Piccadilly, called the Royal Institute for International Affairs, otherwise known as Chatham House. And they are a private club that's been going since the 1920s, funded by all sorts of big business. The BBC and other media people are also subscribers to it and help fund it. And also the big financial institutions fund it. It has an equivalent in the United States called the Council on Foreign Relations. And the big contrast between the democratic institutions like the State Department and the Foreign Office and these private clubs is simply money. These private clubs have fantastic amounts of money to devote to think tanks, articles, journalists, writers to formulate foreign policy. And they are probably something like 90% more powerful in terms of influence than the actual Foreign Office itself. So the policy, many people, is interchangeable. For example, one of the government solicitors who resigned at the time of the Iraq War because she believed it was illegal walked instantly out of the Foreign Office straight into a job at the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So it's the old revolving doors syndrome. The only trouble is that financially and by influence and magazines, they have a magazine called International Affairs and another more tabloid-type magazine called The World Today. The Royal Institute for International Affairs really is in the driving seat and is far more influential, far more powerful than William Hague in the Foreign Office. So it almost doesn't matter who is in that job nowadays, I'm afraid, because they're just a front man for these private clubs.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, the running theme through this whole interview so far, Tony, is that the money is the power in all of this, and that those who have the money and those who have the influence there, at the end of the day, we do have these politicians that are in place, but there's people behind them. I'm not naive to know that there's people behind them that are with the money and with the power.
The people behind them are essentially, sort of private clubs, like I was saying, and there are individuals who are very, very wealthy. But if you think about what's been happening to wealth over the last 50, 60 years since World War II, it's been taken away from individuals and it's going towards a tiny number of individuals, many of whom have got their money, as I say, away from the tax regime, so they're not being taxed on their wealth. And also, of course, the big corporations. We just heard today that Tesco, for example, wants to take over Amazon, the online retailer. Mm. So these kinds of bank accounts that the people and the financial influence that big companies like Tesco have are immense. In fact, if you look at what's also been happening here to do with... In fact, I'm sitting on some land now, which used to be owned by the Milk Marketing Board, if anyone can remember that.
Yeah.
Back in the 1960s, I think it was abolished at the end of the 70s, early 80s. This land used to be public land, which was used for farming cows, which were used to produce milk as a basic utility to make sure the country had a food supply. And now it's been sold off, in fact, to this piece of land particularly, I think it's to the publisher, Kindersley, the publishers. But look, this is what's going on. Is much of our wealth is now in the hands of these secretive corporations. They always hide under the guise of commercial confidentiality. And even, I'm afraid to say, much of our policing and even our military is starting to be privatised. We've heard also today, I don't know if you heard this, that a private company that maintains the fire engines for the whole of the Metropolitan District in London is in financial difficulties. It looks like that might go bust. So does that mean that next week, if a fire engine needs a wheel changing, then I'm afraid that there's going to be nobody there to change the wheel? This is the problem, is that these deals are being done to privatise parts of our essential services in Britain and in other parts of the world, but particularly in Britain at the moment under the Conservatives. And then when those companies then go bust, or the directors have taken far too big a salary or whatever, or the shareholders, and the companies go bust, the public is then again left to pick up the bill. And I think it's about time, we stopped doing this privatising and actually started looking at nationalising, including things like the banking sector. It's not good enough to say we can't afford this. If we had nationalised the banking sector, exactly whatever we want to afford.
The military
privatisation, if I could just go on a little bit about that, because that, some parts of that are really, really worrying. I mean, we've got mercenaries we know are definitely on the ground over in Syria. The Daily Star talked about British troops being on the ground in Syria the weekend before last. And we've had former SAS, are training the Syrian rebels. So, there's a massive amount of private money being made out of these conflicts now, which is the big problem. And if you also go back a few years, I don't know, do you remember the TV journalist Roger Cook?
Yes.
Do you remember the Cook Report?
Yeah, he was down in Spain a lot.
Sorry?
Yeah, he was down in Spain a lot looking at criminals on the Costa del Sol on quite a few occasions. I remember that, yeah.
That's right. I mean, he was all over the world. He did a programme. Now, that programme was called around about 1997, the Cook Report. And, I mean, I've got serious problems with that. I could say the word conspiracy, but maybe I shouldn't. But he was pulling in between about 10 to 12 million viewers per programme. Now, that is it's at least double of any other current affairs programme.
Yeah.
And yet, the programme was pulled. So we have to ask questions about why that was. Well, some of the last programmes he made, one was about the fixing of the music charts in Britain. Another one was about the arms trade. And Roger actually found some weapons-grade plutonium that was being dealt on the black market from the former Soviet Union. Now, this is pretty astounding. And obviously, you know, you would say this is what they're doing is they're winding you up. They're going to take your money and then run. But he took the trouble to ask for a sample of this material and then took it back to be analysed in a laboratory in Britain. And they came back to him and said, where did you get this? Because it really is weapons-grade plutonium. And you have been offered the real stuff. And when he went back to these Ukrainian arms dealers, because this was at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian army hadn't been paid, there were military storage bases and things which were manned by former Soviet soldiers, but they weren't being paid, so they were looking to sell everything in their base off to make a few bob. He was then offered warheads from the SS-20 missile, ballistic missile. Now, this was something they did have in the base. They'd been decommissioned under the SALT Treaty with Reagan in the 1980s. Now, so Roger Cook, the TV reporter, was offered a 150-kiloton thermonuclear warhead from an SS-20 at the same time as we are being told that there's no way that any of these countries like Iran can get hold of these things. Now, I can tell you, if Roger Cook can get hold of a nuclear warhead, then I would say to you, it is absolutely feasible. In fact, it's likely that the Iranian government got hold of one of those warheads, or at least one or two of them too. And just to give you an idea of what 150 kilotons is, 150 kilotons is 10 times the explosion at Hiroshima. And the Hiroshima bomb killed something like 100,000 people. So he was offered a nuclear weapon, which was an actual warhead itself, that is to say, all of the everything except the electronics to actually fire the thing, the explosives, all the complicated work done. The idea that we're being told right across the Western world that we must make sure the Iranians don't have a centrifuge so they can make a little bit of enriched uranium, which is, you know, is another step entirely to getting the plutonium from these bombs. I think we're being sold a pup. And the Israelis right now are saying, we think we can attack Iran and there will only be 60 casualties in Israel. Now, this is absolute rubbish and nonsense, and this is the kind of thing that could start a war, a serious, possibly even a thermonuclear war, because what they're doing is essentially similar to what happened in the 1960s with the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the American military went to Kennedy and they said to him, listen, Mr. Kennedy, we need to go into Cuba right now because they're going to be putting some nuclear weapons in there soon. The fact that we now know is that already Castro has tactical nuclear weapons. So if the American military had been allowed to go into Cuba in 1962, there would have been a nuclear war started straight away.
So, Tony,
Kennedy was absolutely right.
Tony, let me get it straight. You're saying that you believe that Iran already has nuclear capabilities and that should really be known. In order that may actually stop Israel from attacking them in the first place. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying, I think they do. And I think actually that is, if this was more publicly known and also recognised by the hawks in Israel and the United States, I mean, the fact of the matter is, Dave, that many of the retired military are quite happily now saying, this is absolute madness. There's no way we should be attacking Iran. Former head of Mossad and another former head of the armed services in Israel 2 days ago said, this is madness, stop it, stop it. But the thing is that they don't have quite so much access to the media as people like Netanyahu do. And so, you know, we've really got to keep an eye on this conflict, because if the Israelis try it on there, I think, you know, it could be really, they're playing with fire.
But, Tony, put yourself in Israel's position. They've got a country that, you're saying, does already have nuclear capability, and then there's some folks saying they don't. But if Israel are to believe they do, the leader of Israel of Iran's come out and says we want to wipe Israel off the face of the planet, are they not in their right to try and defend themselves?
Yeah, well, of course, everyone has the right of self-defense, but nobody has the right of attack. And that is what is being contemplated right now by Netanyahu. Of course, he's got an election coming up. He can see power slipping away from him, and I think he feels that he could have something electorally to gain by intervening in Iran. But, I mean, there's something called the UN, Dave, called the UN Charter, and it was put together after the experience of dealing with a certain fellow called Adolf Hitler. And, you know, we've really got to, I think, concentrate on that. I mean, actually, if you think about it, the old mutually assured destruction between the Soviet Union and the United States worked, didn't it? I mean, it was a crazy way to run a planet, but actually, one person wasn't going to, one side wasn't going to attack the other because they both knew that they'd both be annihilated if they did. And maybe that is, you know, a far more sensible way to be running the Middle East. Then we can slowly disarm, you know, if we're going to have a little bit of humanity. The trouble is, a lot of the people who've got control of these weapons, they are the types who actually seem to want to use them. A lot of the military, they like using all their hardware. And the kind of language they used back in 1962, I'm talking about General Power and Strategic Air Command, they had something called the missile gap in those days, where the Soviet Union didn't have as many hydrogen bombs as the Americans, but they were catching up. And the argument by the hawks in the United States at the time, General Power and his Curtis Lee May and his friends, was, look, guys, you know, we have to attack the Soviet Union now, otherwise they'll catch up with our number of missiles, and we can attack them now with no more than expectable losses. Now, those expectable losses in the thermonuclear exchange were hundreds of millions of people, but that's the kind of language they were using at the time, and that, I'm afraid, is the kind of lunacy that's being preached right now by the Likud Party in Israel and by some of their friends in the United States about a potential attack on Iran, leaving Syria aside, you know, in all of this for the time being.
Tony, unfortunately, time has beaten us. I've got so many more questions for you, as always.
I think the main message out here is that Netanyahu needs to sit down calmly and watch one of the last episodes of the Cook Report and see if he still thinks that the nuclear weapons were not available on the black market as long ago as the early 1990s.
So what you're saying in a nutshell is that checkmate is a safe place to be if Iran have nuclear and Israel have nuclear capabilities, neither side will likely to use it. It's a safe place to be.
Well, that's the lesson we've learned, isn't it, from the Cold War, actually. And obviously, in another world, and maybe in the future, we can start disarming.
Yeah.
Once we're in a situation of balance, you know, between the two sides.
But Tony, you've got a caller on the line. Let's take this call. Good afternoon, caller. You're live on TRE. Here's calling.
Yes, good afternoon, Dave. It's Gary.
Hi, Gary.
Just a quick question for your guest. Yep. Very interesting. From what he's talking about Iran, can he wind the time factor back so it can't be discounted that Iraq had potential for nuclear weapons, if not nuclear weapons at all?
That Iraq had...
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Iraq, we were told, had weapons of mass destruction. Now, if on the ground, the weapons inspectors like Scott Redford from the US Marines and Hans Blix, they were giving very clear signs that there was no weapons of mass destruction there. I wonder whether it's a sort of, a brain messing psychological operation of some sort where in the old days with Iraq, we were being told that there were weapons of destruction, because that was what the politicians wanted to hear to get their war stuff. They'd always decided to attack Iraq, and all they needed was some kind of lie to spread around the world as an excuse for it. And maybe what we're seeing now is the kind of flip side of that we're also being told another lie, a different lie, the opposite lie, when it comes to Iran. I mean, at the end of the day, the Iranian people are a very old, civilized people. They threw off the yoke of colonialism from the United States back in the 1980s when they had their revolution. And the Americans have never forgiven them in a similar way to the Europeans not giving Gaddafi for having his little military coup back in the 60s. So, you know, I think that's essentially what's going on, is we're just being told a total lie by this controlled mainstream media, which is all controlled from London. You know, if you listen to what we're saying in Bristol, we're saying something a bit different.
Okay, Gary, does that answer it?
Yeah, sort of, but just as an aside, the comment was made about weapons-grade uranium being touted around on the market. It's a known fact, it's a documented fact, that the Quay twins, the infamous gangsters of East End of London in the 60s, were actually involved in the deal where they were actually buying or trying to buy weapons-grade plutonium.
Okay.
That's just an aside, anyway.
Gary, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. And Tony, we're going to have to go as well, I'm afraid. So thanks for coming on, and no doubt we'll be speaking again in the near future.
Just plug the website.
Yeah, certainly. Go for it.
For the radio show. People can download the podcast. My regular guest on there is old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. He's the only economist I've ever met that talks sense, and actually I think it helps the listeners to actually understand economics rather than pull the wool over their eyes, as so many economists do.
And Martin's on here regularly as well, yeah, so they'll know him, yeah.
Yeah, Martin's back again. He's been away during August, and he was back with a bang last week. So our site is www.thisweek.org.uk, and you can have a look at all sort of podcasts there. This week coming up, it's nearly the anniversary of the September the 11th attacks, so we're going to be doing a little bit on those. Yeah. You know, the war on freedom, which has resulted from it, and also we had the anniversary of Diana last weekend, and so we'll be having a brief look at that, and also reviewing a new book on the debt finder, which I'd recommend to all your listeners, which is really an incredible piece of work, putting together all of the police inquiry in France, the police inquiries in London, and also all the evidence that was given at the inquest. And John Morgan from Australia went through all this and put together a very easily readable 160-page book explaining exactly what happened, called The Assassination of Princess Diana, The Paris-London Connection.
Tony, thank you for coming on, Tony. Enjoy the countryside, won't you? And hope you enjoy it and relax and make the most of it while you're there. And the nice weather that's there in the UK.
Thank you.
Cheers, Tony. Speak to you soon.
Thanks a lot,
mate. Cheers.
Much appreciated. God bless.
Tony Gosling there from Bilderberg.org.
Hello, this is David the Dog Man. Don't forget, it's very hot out at the moment. Don't leave your dogs in cars, please. And keep them out the sun. No walks till the evenings or very early morning.